Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, school is about to start, but CMS has hundreds of teacher vacancies. That's actually normal, and we'll tell you why. What isn't normal is that many elementary teachers are failing to pass their licensing exams. A new CMPD task force forms to stop the rash of shootings into homes. Wells Fargo says it's sorry for yet another problem that has surfaced involving foreclosures, which they attribute to faulty software. A judge refuses to rule on a request to block some constitutional amendment questions on this November's ballot. Plus, football season is underway, with the Panthers playing their first preseason game last night, which they won against the Buffalo Bills. Our roundtable of reporters is ready to detail those stories and others. And those reporters include Alex Olgan from WFAE News. And Doss Helms is back, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer, going to get a workout this morning. Mary C. Curtis, columnist for Roll Call and reporter or contributor to WCCB-TV. And Sean Flynn,
morning,
managing editor for Spectrum News. Good morning to you all.
Good morning. Good
morning.
We're all on the radio, but if that's not enough, we're on Facebook Live. You get the back of Alex and Mary's heads this morning until we get our extra cameras in here. Okay, let's start with teacher vacancies. You reported, Ann, last week that CMS has posted about 450 teacher vacancies, and we're how many weeks away from the start of school? How many weeks?
Less than three now. Yeah, about two. And it is down. It's down to about... They have 372 what they call instructional vacancies. I mean, more than 300 of those are teachers. There are also some facilitators, deans of students, counselors. But, yeah, this always happens, as you noted. At the beginning of the year, you know, you get closer and you get closer, and the numbers change literally several times a day. So
Why do we always have several hundred vacancies at the start of the school year? And sometimes going into the first couple of weeks of school?
That's you really hope you don't have them going in, because that is, you know, when you start talking about a class that is not does not have a permanent teacher, you're either distributing students out to their colleagues until you can get a permanent person, or you're hiring a long-term sub, which is not ideal. So I think it's just part of the game of hiring. Again, Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools has about 9,000 teachers, so 300 sounds like a lot. It's about 3%, I think. Mm-hmm. So you have all this churn, and you know, as we maybe hire somebody away from Union County Schools, oh, look who has a last-minute vacancy. Meanwhile, you know,
right? So it's musical
Austin County hires, yeah, exactly. Musical There's chairs. A lot of musical chairs,
and we don't really. They don't know. They don't get advanced warning before August that this is going to happen. Or do they know in June that they're going to have X number of vacancies?
They almost always have vacancies. They are in continual hiring mode, and I don't know if there's a drop-dead point at which you can't give notice. You know, one would assume it would not be kosher to, you know, if school's opening on August 27th to the Friday before that, say, oh, yeah, you know what, I'm going somewhere else. But
The system held a 6-week crash course for career changers and non-traditional college students who want to become teachers. Do they do this every year?
It used to be known as the lateral entry pathway. Uh-huh. So somebody like me, if I suddenly decided, you know, I know how to write and I would be a great high school English teacher, they would have hired me and I would have had to learn on the job, and I would have had, I think, 3 years to earn my license. And what they did was change that to a residency approach, so which seems to make sense to me, that you now have to do some kind of program so you have some on-the-job teaching about how to teach, you know, because I might be great at writing a newspaper article and really bad at handling a room full of teenagers. Pretty sure that would literally be true. So they now have this program where you spend 6 weeks, and it involves student teaching, so you're doing summer school student teaching before you actually take your own classroom. You have instructors who are talking to you about classroom management and lesson plans and all that stuff that you don't know if you are not either an education major or an experienced teacher.
So is this a tried and true way to fill some of these hundreds of vacancies they have at the top of the year every year, or is this something totally unrelated to that?
It is a part of that, and it always has been. There was literally a group called Teach Charlotte that was doing lateral entry training, and they've kind of morphed into this new residency program.
What are non-traditional college graduates? What does that mean?
Say you're a math major. And you might be really, really desirable as a math teacher because you always need math teachers. but you didn't major in education. So again, you're trying to catch up on those skills that are not just your content area, but that are how you teach kids.
Go ahead, Sean.
Well, first of all, I'd like to say, Anne, I think you'd be a great teacher if this is a something that you're looking into.
She's very good with noun-verb agreement.
Absolutely. I'm sure she could correct my English right now. I would just like to add a little perspective to it. Yeah, every year CMS does deal with the same issue. If you think about it, you know, 150-some-odd schools. So you're looking at basically, on average, two teachers a school. So you know, when you put a little perspective on it, I've noticed in the last couple of days that over in Union County, the superintendent over there, Mr. Houlihan, has been posting lots of pictures at different schools saying, hey, I'm over here at this school, 100% of teacher positions filled. So I don't know if he's taking a knock at CMS or he's just proud of his what he's doing. And then the last thing I would like to say is, yeah, absolutely, this training program is critically important. Every now and then I teach an adjunct course at college, and the first time I did it, I had really no idea what I was doing going into a classroom. I knew the topic. I knew how to teach that stuff, but dealing with students is an entirely different ballgame. So if I could say, I think it's a great idea that they're trying to get some of that classroom training prior to going into the classroom.
Mary.
Yeah, and I was also going to say that they've used programs like this before. Teach for America is something that brings folks in, young people from colleges. But I know that with that program, it's also a churn. Some people do that for a couple of 2 or 3 years, and then they move on.
So. And that's part of the CMS program. They're saying that Teach for America is, by definition, you commit to 2 years. You might stay 3 or 4. But they are looking by specifically recruiting among CMS employees, such as teacher assistants, by recruiting from people who are already working in, say, social services in the community. They are looking to get people who will stick with it, who already know the community, care about the kids. And they are much more skewed toward people of color than the teaching force. It's almost completely flipped. I think it's about 3/4 of the teachers are white, and about 3/4, or maybe more like 70%, of these candidates are people of color.
So Sean mentioned the superintendent at Union County being very proud of the fact that they're 100% filled with teachers and maybe taking a shot across the bow at CMS. Is that what he's doing, do you think? You know this guy, I would imagine, right?
I don't know the Union County superintendent, and there's always a little bit of cross rivalry, but there's also just a lot of talking up your own district, and you know, he probably has schools that are not filled that he's not highlighting.
Right.
And it's great, you look at them by schools, and Sean's right, most of them have 2, 3, 4 vacancies, maybe none. There are some schools where you think there's got to be some real stress. Olympic High, as of last night, was listed as having 18 teacher vacancies. And that's a school that's going through some restructuring. They've just gone from 5 academies to back to one big school. There are a few high schools that have enough gaps that you think their principal's got to be sweating bullets.
So CMS Superintendent Clayton Wilcox shared his thoughts on the cause of the shortage of teachers with WBTV.
Finding great elementary teachers has become a huge challenge to the school system.
Why?
You know, I think fewer kids are entering the colleges of education in general, and I just believe that people see these starting salaries as not something that they're going to pursue after a 4-year college education.
If that's right, and it probably is, at least to a degree, we have a problem not just here but nationwide, it would seem to me. Would that be accurate?
Absolutely. The pipeline, as they call it, the number of graduates coming out of colleges of education has been declining in North Carolina and around the country. So the population is sort of starting to level off the school edge population, but the demand for teachers is definitely outstripping the supply.
I think this is actually something we're seeing it's almost generational. Earlier this year, we did a story about how a lot of popular summertime teenage jobs for teenagers, they're not finding the teenagers. Lifeguards, we featured a 54-year-old lifeguard and how great of a job she does, and how these pool companies are having to go out and find more experienced help like that, because teenagers frankly just don't want these type of jobs. We offered somebody earlier this year, a college graduate just stepping foot out of college, a very competitive salary, and that person said, "Nah, that's not enough for me." I think the expectations are rising a little bit of the college grads.
Somebody needs to do a story on what jobs teenagers do want to do. What do teens do for summer jobs?
Video gaming,
well, that's
social
what I'm saying.
Media.
Yes, because they don't work at McDonald's either. So
No, they don't work there. It's a struggle. I mean, just look at Carowinds. They're struggling a lot of times to hire some of those teenagers who are normally filling those jobs.
I could take the summer off. And
there you go.
Have teenager fill your spot.
That's exactly right.
The people who need the jobs do take them, whether they're in the school year or whatever. And so.
So meanwhile, about 2,400 North Carolina elementary school teachers have failed the math portion of their licensing exam. This story got national attention. Is this particular to Mecklenburg County? Or
no.
Is this going all over North Carolina?
All over North Carolina. This was a change that came about 4 years ago as they made the transition to Common Core, which is standards for students, but then the state decided to revamp its licensure agreements as well. Nobody paid much attention because really how sexy is teacher licensure until something goes wrong with it. So they switched their agreement from a group called ETS, a nonprofit group, to Pearson, which is a national for-profit education company. They adopted the exams. They say that the Pearson is doing some type of teacher licensure exams in 24 states, but they said, we want the same one as Massachusetts has. They apparently viewed that as sort of a role model for high-quality education, and they adopted this. And so if you are in elementary school, you know, if you're in higher middle school, you're probably just teaching math or just teaching history or whatever, but in elementary, you're teaching a classroom, so you've got to kind of know everything. So you have to pass this test that includes general knowledge, it includes a reading portion, it includes a math portion, and the math portion is what's tanking for people.
So now, which teachers take this test? All of them, or just early, new
just
teachers?
Just early teachers. If you already have your license, nobody's going to come in and say, boom, you have to pass this math test or you're fired. But if you, it used to be that you had to pass your licensure exams before you could get hired, but part of the new arrangement was you could get hired and you have 2 years to pass them. So what's happening is you have teachers that people are saying they're great. You know, they get great results with their kids. In some cases, they're saying, I was named new teacher of the year. You know, I got a bonus for the results I got with my kids. But they're not passing that exam, so they are looking at losing their jobs.
So these are relatively new teachers,
yes,
who are going back after a couple of years in the classroom to get their complete certification. And these could be elementary school teachers. They could be high school teachers.
This is does not affect high school teachers. It affects
elementary. That's why I'm asking.
Right, elementary and also special education, K-12, which is a whole different dynamic too. But we're getting a lot of them who are saying, I'm really great at teaching my population.
Yeah.
Not so great at, you know, algebra.
We're going to come back to that part in a second here. Mark Jewell, the president of the North Carolina Association of Educators, told WBTV that he worries the licensing exam failures will worsen the teacher shortage crisis.
I'm very concerned when I hear about principals losing teachers, really good teachers, mm-hmm, who have great evaluations, but because they can't pass this new assessment, they're having to release them from their job and having no certified teacher to replace them with. That's problematic.
So how many teachers at CMS has this impacted?
That's a great question, and one that I started asking more than a week ago, and I have not gotten a response. I think this is evolving and confusing in some cases to principals and to districts. One of the things that happened in July over a phone call Board of Education meeting was that they said, okay, we know this problem is emerging. We're hearing about this. Let's give them an extra year to pass. So at that point, the districts had the ability to say, if you've finished your 2 years and you haven't passed, you've got an extra year to keep trying. It is not clear to me whether CMS knew about that. I think the word is just filtering out to more than 100 HR departments and, you know, thousands of principals. I talked to CMS teachers who said, I was let go, you know, but part of the dynamic is also that if you're that teacher, you're paying $94 each time you retake that test. And it's clear to me how many of them are saying, I'm out, I'm not doing this.
It costs $278 to take the battery of test and $94 each time you have to retake the math portion of the test. And this teachers pay for this personally.
They do, yes.
This is not the system.
I had sort of thought the state was writing a big old check, but no, the teachers.
We're not done talking about this. We'll come back and talk just a bit more about this in a moment. It's the News Roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Alex Olgan is here from WFAE News. Mary C. Curtis, columnist and contributor to RollCall.com and WCCB-TV. Sean Flynn, managing editor of Spectrum News. And Ann Doss Helms, education reporter. This is the Ann Doss Helms show so far for the Charlotte Observer. I want to get back to this test that we've been talking about, because you put a link in your story online. You put a link, and we're going to link to that on our website, to some sample questions for this test. And in fact, I think you can download the whole test.
There's a whole practice test, 46 questions. You're supposed to do it in 2.5 hours.
So I put my superior brain to work yesterday and went in and tried to take the sample test. And let's just say I could not answer most of them. Okay, any of them.
You pulled the full Blutarski. 0 points here.
Yeah. You get 100 for honesty.
Now, math was never my strong suit, which explains why I'm in broadcasting and my salary.
It was my strong suit. I had over 700 on the SAT. I use math regularly in this job to analyze and look at data. I looked at that test, and I have not had a lot of time these last few days. I haven't sat down and tried to work it, but I was flummoxed.
I did well in geometry, and I took Algebra 2 three times. So,
you were really good at it.
Third time's a charm, yeah.
So, but I'd never seen some of these things
before. The way they teach and talk about math is changing really quick. Some of this is Common Core math, and I think this is for parents and grandparents who are looking at this, it's like trying to read another language.
This is why I wanted to know if this is elementary teachers taking this, because there'd be no reason for them to teach any of this in elementary school. It would seem to me to be all in high school, Algebra 2 and above.
Well, the argument for it, and I've talked to a couple of professors of education who teach teachers to teach math, and they say, A, it's not totally unreasonable to say that a recent college graduate should be able to demonstrate that they know high school math. You know, they are college graduates, and they did finish high school, one assumes. And that teachers in the younger grades are teaching the concepts that will prepare you to succeed in the higher levels of math. But the education professors that I have spoken to say, you aren't really looking to just weed out people who aren't good at math. You know, it would be one thing if you had 10 great candidates for every job, and if you're not a math person, tough luck. You know, now it's down to 9. A, we need the people, and B, what they ought to be testing is your ability to teach math to the younger kids.
Are we the only state that's having this problem with this test, the Pearson test?
No. Massachusetts has similar low pass rates. They do get better when you start retaking and retaking, although, again, this is, you know, something that you're going to lose some people.
So is this the test's fault, or are we witnessing what one letter to the editor said, the laying off of blame from the teachers not knowing the material to the test?
Well, and another question is whether the colleges of education are doing what they ought to do to prepare teachers. So all of these questions are being asked. I think what you're hearing state officials say is that the easy solution and the wrong solution would be to just set a much lower threshold for passing. And the phrase that you'll hear a lot, including from Craig Horn, who is a Union County representative in charge of the Education Committee, is we don't want to dumb down the test. So they don't want to do something that's just perceived as artificially making it easier to pass, but you want to make sure you're asking the right things. And I think... One of the things that I've heard bounced around is maybe there should be a separate licensure even for K-3, because what you need to do with kindergarten kids is not teaching them algebraic concepts.
That's right. Okay, so we've put a link on our website, wfae.org/charlottetalks, to Ann's link, which will take you to the sample questions, and you can take the test yourself. And if you pass, I want to hear from you.
We'll have a special show on people who can pass this exam.
We'll have you all on the air simultaneously, all two of you.
And there are some future vacancies. So,
So CMS, yes, there are vacancies. Yes. You can fill the vacancies. CMS announced this week that Hopewell High School principal John Dino Gisiano, who was suspended in July, has resigned now, and they have not revealed the reason except to say that it did not involve any students. They were very specific about that. What do we know?
We don't know much at all. I mean, sometimes this kind of is the way this plays out, because principals tend to be a community figure. There's a lot of interest in who is the principal of a large high school that serves, in this case, the Huntersville area. So people care and know, but the personnel law in North Carolina says that there is very little that must be disclosed or even can be disclosed.
Matt Hayes with CMS says that an employee's personnel information regarding investigations or suspensions is not available for disclosure under the state's personnel laws. Now, we had this problem with Heath Morrison. We still don't know precisely why that superintendent was summarily dismissed. But these people are all state employees who interact with our children. Why shouldn't we know?
Well, that's a question for our lawmakers.
Why would that be private? These people work for us.
And you use the phrase summarily dismissed. If they are actually dismissed, fired, then their letter of dismissal is public record. But what you see, what you saw with Heath Morrison, what you saw in this case, what you almost always see when you see a notice that says a principal has been suspended, that principal's not coming back. They probably will agree to resign, in which case the resignation, any reasons behind that are private.
Yeah, but he's being transferred to be the principal, of the Beatty's Ford Road School?
I don't think so. I was told that he had resigned from CMS.
Oh, okay.
Because there you go.
Yeah. I think they were saying Hope Wells is on Beatty's Ford Road.
Oh. Yeah. Okay. And they brought a retired principal in to take that job
now,
temporarily.
We talked a little bit about this on Thursday's show and the fact that U.S. Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos is, and this is kind of a switch, but it's still educational related, she's pushing rules to make it more difficult for students defrauded by for-profit colleges to get their federal loans forgiven. A reporter that we had on that program on Thursday from the Chronicle of Higher Education interjected the word impossible when I mentioned that it was going to be more difficult. He said, no, it's going to be impossible for them to be forgiven their loans if they've been defrauded. This has resonance in Charlotte because several public for-profit schools closed here recently, the Charlotte School of Law, Regency Beauty Institute, the ITT Technical College, Art Institute of Charlotte. Is the prospect of fraud associated with any of those schools?
I understand the label impossible because I think to show that they intentionally made false promises is going to be really difficult to do. I think they say things like, get a great job, we're preparing non-traditional students.
How much of the impetus for making it so difficult to get your loans forgiven when you've been defrauded by schools comes from the fact that Betsy DeVos and her family own for-profit schools, and so did the president?
Alex, you've been waving your hand.
Yeah, I can't answer that question. I'm sure that former employees from those schools now being in the department has an impact. But I was just going to say shifting the burden of proof to the students who now can't pay back this money, didn't necessarily finish school to then prove all this information or hire a lawyer to then prove all this information, like your guest said, I would imagine would be next to impossible. I mean, I was a student not too long ago, and if I was in that situation, I don't know what I would do.
So this is being positioned as a way to protect the taxpayer because, as the Conservative Heritage Foundation claims, any student could raise their hand and qualify for free money under the old policy. But wouldn't continuing this policy shine a bright light on practices by some of these schools that take taxpayer-funded student loan money and then don't use it properly?
Yeah, it's kind of whether you focus on a market-based approach, which is, hey, they're out there in the market, and if you buy what they're selling, that's your problem. And if you take out a big loan and you're not able to pay it off, that's your problem, not the government's problem, versus, like you say, more of the government's going to take ownership in this because these companies, I think, probably would not be in business if they could not get federal student loans.
But it's not really a surprise coming from Betsy DeVos and this education department, education secretary, because they have been pulling back on regulatory issues all throughout the education system, from disciplinary guidelines from the Obama administration to this particular piece. And as you said, Mike, she worked with for-profit. She never worked with public education.
Right.
So you can see that it's always going to be taking this particular tack.
So this might be a good time to jump off into something else that has traditionally been government operated and now is moving toward privatization. And we're talking about now North Carolina looking for insurance companies because it's privatizing its Medicaid system, which you reported on, Alex, yesterday, I believe.
Yes. Lots of other states have done this. It's what you have to get federal approval. Because Medicaid is a federal program. There is state dollars that go to it, but so do federal dollars. And then states, instead of acting like insurance companies, go out and find insurance companies to contract to. Some doctors are nervous about this because they are fearing that reimbursement rates may go lower. Mm-hmm. They may get paid less for the services that they were providing before. But the department said yesterday, no, we're going to make sure that these companies will pay at least 100% of the rates that doctors are getting now. But then they talked about some other what they call value-based payment systems. And that's a complicated word for we want to pay you based on how healthy you keep your patients. And that's what's concerning some doctors, because some doctors who treat not so healthy patients fear that they may lose out a little bit.
And one would think that people who are in Medicaid are probably among the least healthy in the country because their access to medical care hasn't been so great over
exactly.
the years.
And that is what some doctors argue. This is a big contract. The state is looking to fill $6 billion a year.
You report that North Carolina is the largest state that has not moved its Medicaid program to a privately run system.
Yeah, and that's what the Secretary of Health said yesterday on this call, that we are the largest one that has not yet done it. And just one other point of clarification, we don't even technically have the final federal approval to go ahead and do this. But the Secretary of Health, who, by the way, used to work at the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, is so confident that we will get the final federal approval that she's going ahead and asking for these bids now.
Okay. Wells Fargo, again in the news this week, between 2010 and 2015, 625 Wells Fargo customers were denied or not offered modification to home mortgages that could have made them more affordable. These were people who were damaged by the economic downturn, the financial crisis that led to the Great Recession. 400 of those people had their homes foreclosed on. The bank knew about this years ago, but just revealed it to the government in July. I asked Dion Roberts from The Observer about this yesterday. I said, why did it take so long for us to find out? I don't know, he said. We don't know yet. So this week they blamed it on a software glitch. What was the software supposed to do?
I guess calculate if you're eligible for these modifications.
So the software couldn't pass that CMS math test. it was supposed to calculate the debt-to-income ratio, and it set the floor at 31%, so that if your income equaled more than 31%, if your mortgage payment equaled more than 31% of your income, the computer denied you a loan modification. So they therefore you got foreclosed on. Now the bank is offering $8 million in restitution to the 625 customers who have yet to be contacted. They may not even know they're in the pool yet. But that works out to $12,800 per person. Is that enough money? I mean, these people lost their homes.
Yeah, and not to mention emotional distress. I can't imagine $12,000 would cover more than a couple payments, you know?
It's hard to go back and see how their families and everything were affected. I listened to the show you did on that, and you talk about work was affected, employment, family issues. And so, wow, that's a lot.
Yeah. Well, we'll wait for the next shoe. CMPD says there have been hundreds of cases this year in which people shot firearms into occupied homes and apartments. And that number could actually be higher, they say, because a lot of people simply don't report these incidences. And CMPD Captain Stephen Fishbach says that they don't report them because they're too afraid to.
This is your neighborhood. We cannot do this alone. We have to have the cooperation of the community.
He sounds very much like the chief of police in Chicago because of last weekend's 70-some shootings up in Chicago and the people in Chicago not willing to come forward and report. Why are people here afraid to report these incidences?
I imagine the reasons.
Same reasons?
I mean, I don't know.
Retaliation?
I imagine some of them are similar. If you're living in a place where there's a lot of shootings and then you snitch, so to speak, mm-hmm. on people you know, I can imagine that might be dangerous to then go back to that same neighborhood where people are angry that you maybe turn them in.
And also, I think, you know, we have to also, this is an underlying piece of a community trusting the police department. Do they care? Will they, you know, treat each person as an individual? You know, so I think that's a piece of it as well. And maybe they just throw up their hands and say, you know what, they don't care. And I'm not saying that, you know, the police department has been reaching out to those communities and they're doing it now, but that's a piece of it as well.
So the victims have been as young as six, and the shooters as young as 14. The police instituted a task force in July to deal with this and put shooters behind bars. What has come of this task force? Do we know?
Well, I believe they said within the first couple of weeks they've made 9 arrests so far, which sounds, you know, not bad for the first couple of weeks. But you almost saw just at that news conference, it sounded like some of the officers and members of the police department, they're a little exasperated here. They're like, come on, people, we need help. I'm tired of this. Why are 14-year-olds even having guns, and why are they shooting at people? I think that's kind of the, you know, we've heard it over and over again with a lot of the homicides this year. A lot of the homicides have been teenage victims shot by teenagers. Why is this happening? And I think it's just a systemic problem that they are trying to figure out a solution to it, and I think they're looking to the community to try and get some help on that.
Okay. The Observer published an editorial this week about Charlotte's perennial problem, the lack of affordable housing, saying that though this prosperous city insists it wants to provide enough affordable housing for its lower-income residents and has taken steps to do so, they are mostly baby steps, and we keep stubbing our toe. Is that a fair assessment, Mary?
Well, it's kind of true. This is a perennial problem, and when we had the new mayor, Vi Lyles, what is top on the agenda? Affordable housing. And when you go down the street and see all the development, you're like, well, we have plenty of apartments going up. But, you know, we had a project in Dilworth, and that's what the editorial mentioned, the Strong Cottages, that had a few homes for moderate income folks.
Which were torn down to make way for development
that is still not there. It's been years. And even that was going to, the development was only going to reserve, you know, mainly just a small percentage for folks who reach this particular threshold, which was earning between 65 and 80% of the area median income. And actually, the most dire shortage is folks around here making between 30 and 50% of the median income. So we are a prosperous city in some ways, but this is a problem that keeps coming up. And because of our laws and rules about zoning and things like that, you know, not every place has to provide. You know, we don't have as strict as some cities like New York where, you know, every developer has to provide a certain amount of affordable housing.
And that's because we can't. Yeah. The city is asking for $50 million. They're going to put a bond on the referendum on the November ballot for $50 million. It's usually $15 million every 2 years. Now it's going to be 50. They want $50 million more from the corporate community. They want $50 million more from the faith community. So they'll have $150 million to do this. But the city has no bullets in their gun. They can't make developers do any of this. Is that what the real problem is?
Well, they can't. That's true. And if you're going to build a place, you're going to want market rate housing, particularly in an area where the property values are skyrocketing.
We have to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about something else that may affect homeowners: revaluation. That's a dirty word, isn't it? It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is taking our next local news roundup on the road. Join us at the People's Market on East Boulevard at Kenilworth on Friday, August 17th at 9 a.m. More info, including how to get to the People's Market, at wfae.org/charlottetalks. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup, our Friday tradition here with Sean Flynn, managing managing editor of Spectrum News. Mary C. Curtis is here from RollCall.com, and Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer, and Alex Olgan from WFAE News. Mecklenburg County is doing property revaluation assessments, and we are told we should prepare ourselves. Bum, bum, bum. We may have sticker shock next year when we get our tax bills, they say. But then again, they also say, not necessarily. Sean, what does this mean? Are we or aren't we going to be sticker shocked?
Well, I know for sure I'm going to be a little surprised next year. I'm in one of those neighborhoods where a developer is tearing down a home every other week and building up a huge McMansion. And when I bought my home 11 years ago, it was nowhere near the value of what it's currently.
Well, that's my question. Just because they're putting up a McMansion next to you. So let's just say that you live in a $250,000 house. Then house next door was $250,000 until somebody came in, knocked it down, and put a 5,000-square-foot, million-dollar home on it. Why should your property be valued at more than at that equal level when your house is still a $250,000 house.
Mike, I absolutely agree with you, and I hope the tax assessor is listening right now. No, it's all about location. So if the reason why someone's tearing down that house is and building a million-dollar house is because that's a desired location,
right.
And then it just, when you have a million-dollar house, it just raises the value of all the homes. That's when you sell your home, it's based on comps in your neighborhood. So that's how the tax assessor is basing his or her decision.
Yeah, the idea would be that it is no longer a $250,000 home, that you could probably sell it for $500,000, which may well be true. That's what it's based on. But if you're not selling it, and if you're, you know, still making payments on an income where that $250,000 was attainable and the $500,000 is not,
yeah,
that's
but
where you,
know,
you really feel the pinch.
If your roof is 20 years old and you don't have an island and an open floor plan and the house next door does because it was just built, you're not going to get $100,000 more for your house. I can tell you that from experience.
You're getting personal, Mike. Also, aren't there some city and county mandated increases built into that as well?
So, but also the county could vote to keep things revenue neutral, which means I've read in the paper this morning, it means you're not only could you stay where you are, your property tax bill might go down.
That's true. Actually, for some people, it could theoretically go down. And I remember 8 years ago during the controversial reevaluation, they actually did vote to become revenue neutral. Now, revenue neutral means a lot of things to a lot of different people. Theoretically, you're supposed to keep what the county would bring in. They would reset the tax rate to keep the dollars amount the same.
Mm-hmm.
Now, trying to figure that out, somehow the county always ends up bringing in a little bit more, and the city always resets it to bring in a little bit more. But so let's say to get that $2.1 billion they need, I'm just making up numbers here, 75 cents per $100,000 in value or $100 in value, forgive me. So if your value all of a sudden, you know, the entire county goes up, they reset it down to 65 cents to get that same $2.1 billion. That's what that means to be tax revenue neutral.
You mentioned the bad revaluation that we went through a couple of years ago. In 2011, thousands of people protested, and they won. We are told that this time it will be different because the county has their act together. What does that mean?
Well, I was one of the people who protested and didn't win, so I don't know.
Bitter. He's bitter.
Not at all. And if anyone from the tax assessor's listening, office is listening, I'm not bitter whatsoever. Please don't look at my house. There was definitely a lot of problems. I mean, homes really valued way over what they should have been valued. They're using a lot more of the technology around here to try and do better comparisons, so that you're actually assessed what your home should be valued at.
Both the city and the county have decided we're going to have a tax increase, a property tax increase. How does that fit in with these revaluations? Does that not say that all of our taxes are going to be going up, really? I mean, I don't understand that.
Well, you should have all received your property tax bill in the mail this past week, and I know mine went up for this year. So the property tax increase from the city and the county this year really shouldn't have much of an impact for the revaluation outside of them trying to collect the same amount of money and become revenue neutral.
Okay, so there will be constitutional amendments on the ballot in November, and lawsuits were filed over the language Republicans used in writing them, claiming that language that they're using is false and misleading, but the judge hearing the case refused to rule. Why?
And he's sending it to a 3-judge panel to take a look at this issue. I mean, there's always debate about how the questions are worded on the ballot, and it can make a huge difference. Sometimes they can be really confusing and have multiple parts, and you think you're responding to one, you're responding to the whole thing. So this is always
an issue. Are they deliberately confusing, or because these are legal things, they're just confusing because they have to say things in a certain way that people don't speak like that, so they don't know what they're reading?
I think it depends who's writing them and what their intent is.
And you know, some of them, like these photo ID bills have been rejected in North Carolina by the courts, you know, saying that they look like they were going after minorities with almost surgical precision. So lo and behold, it's showing up again on the Constitution. And so, of course, the NAACP they're suing about it because they're saying you're trying to get this in. And when you put it in an amendment, as you say, Alex, with the wording, you have to show photo ID. People say, oh, okay, why not? And there's this whole background to it. So this is, you know, also the other, so many of these other amendments want to pull Roy Cooper, governor's power away from him.
Yeah, part of the background of that voter ID thing is that they're going to decide on the wording of what's going to be on the ballot that will read in the voting booth, but they haven't written the law yet. They'll do that after we say yes. Governor Roy Cooper was challenging both the amendment that would move the authority that you just referred to over filling vacant judgeships and controlling board and commission appointments from the executive to the legislative branch, while the state NAACP, and this is an interesting coalition, the Clean Air Carolina, sought to block amendment questions that would enshrine the need for photo ID to vote into the state constitution and reduce the state income tax cap. They want to cap income tax at a certain level that it could never go over, which might handicap the state in times of need, I suppose. So is that it for these moves? Does that mean that these amendments will, in fact, appear on the ballot in November? Are we done with this, or does the three-judge panel have to rule?
I'm pretty sure that the three-judge panel, it's up to them now. So we'll have to see what they decide or when that even happens.
They've got to start wording these things to get the ballots.
Right. The Board of Elections said they need some decisions this week.
And each side is going to then have to, you know, campaign and try to tell the voters what they think they mean, what they really mean, and what they should mean.
And you reported this week, Alex, on something that was going on in Greensboro. Three Greensboro residents who are challenging a city ordinance in that city that criminalizes aggressive panhandling. These are people who are living in poverty, begging on the streets. It's a federal lawsuit. What does it argue?
So it says that cities shouldn't restrict or can't. It's unconstitutional to restrict First Amendment speech privileges based on certain what they're asking for, which is, you know, donations or solicitations. And these kinds of ordinances have been struck down in other cities.
100% of them, according to the ACLU.
Yeah. I mean, in Cleveland and Dallas and Denver. So I'm not really sure. And apparently, according to the lawsuit, the city attorney had advised the city council that some of this wording could be problematic, but they went ahead anyways. So we'll see what happens with that.
So if this were to be, if the courts decide that you're right, you can't strike that, you can't prevent this from happening, would there be an impact here and in every city in the country?
Well, since they've already ruled on so many of these ordinances, I'm not really sure why cities are continuing to use that same language. There are some cities like Portland, Maine, that have just done away with those ordinances and actually offered certain jobs, like picking up garbage to people who would be panhandling and then paying them. So that's one option. I'm not saying that solves the problem, but people have the right to solicit donations if they so choose. And according to, you know, it's First Amendment right to free speech, and they should have equal protection to say what they want, just like anybody else. You don't have to like what they're saying, or you don't have to give them money. But, you know, what these lawyers argue is they can ask.
Okay. Well, we'll see what happens with that as we go forward. What is that, you ask? That is the sound of fireworks at the Carolina's Panther Fest, or the Carolina Panthers Fest, which helps to ring in the start of the Panther season, which brings fans and a new owner and a new opportunity for optimism, particularly after last night's game.
I've been a Panther fan since 1995, and hoping with the new recruits that we got in that we're going to have a great season. Maybe go back to the Super Bowl.
He's not the only person who thinks we may have a shot at the Super Bowl. The team played their first preseason game last night in Buffalo against the Bills. From what happened on the field, are those hopes justified? This is the first game. This is silly to talk about the Super Bowl for a preseason game. But, Sean, you watched the first half.
I watched the second. Well, for the on-the-field action, I would like to see more of Moore and see less of Seymour. What I mean by that is DJ Moore, the rookie first-round pick, he was phenomenal. He had six catches, 75 yards, and I feel like I'm on a sports talk radio show here. But he was phenomenal. We had a cornerback who kept getting burned and actually cost the team a touchdown by former Panthers Kelvin Benjamin.
Speaking of which...
We got beef. Kelvin and Cam.
The week began with some trash talking about Panthers quarterback Cam Newton from former Panther, now Buffalo Bill, Kelvin Benjamin. How did that did that manifest itself during the game? We'll talk about the pregame in a second. Did that manifest itself during the game?
Well, Kelvin Benjamin had a great first drive, capped off by that touchdown, where he then went into the crowd, and he had a good game for his one series that he was in. Cam Newton was in for just a couple series and performed very well himself. He threw very accurately. So, that was Kelvin's big beef with Cam, that he couldn't throw accurately. So, you know, it's preseason. It doesn't really matter all that much. But, based on what happened, they both performed well.
Yeah, so Benjamin was basically saying that his time at the Panthers was, although he started out being a pretty good friend to Cam, his time with the Panthers would have been better if they had a better quarterback, a different quarterback, a more accurate quarterback. And so last night before the game, evidently, Cam walked up to him on the field and they had a conversation. Now, a lot of video was shot of this conversation, but no audio was able to be picked up from this conversation. But the body language would indicate Cam was not pleased.
Yeah, I would love to have been a mosquito on that field right there because, it just from what it looked like, I'm pretty sure Cam was just saying to Kelvin, hey, what's up? How's Buffalo? No, that's not it at all.
But in the game, there was no kneeling or raising a fist, and that's an issue that is over the NFL. And the Eagles and Dolphins and the Jags game, you did see some demonstrations of that, and that's another issue that's not resolved.
Okay, yeah, absolutely.
Definitely not.
So evidently, Kelvin Benjamin believes he could have been better with any quarterback other than Cam, but several NFL receivers came to Newton's defense, including Steve Smith, the man who Benjamin was drafted to replace in 2014, and he criticized Benjamin for not taking responsibility for or acknowledging his own shortcomings, but that isn't the only reason that Smith was in the news this week. He told NFL.com that during his 16 years in the league, many of them with the Panthers, he battled depression. He said he came forward to help others. Men don't admit things like this usually. Is it likely that his revealing that he, quote, routinely felt trapped, inferior, and alone until he sought help, likely to motivate others to seek help?
When someone's so strong and successful and powerful in the public eye that people admire come out, I think it always is terrific because it makes folks realize they're not alone and it affects everyone. And Steve Smith already is really well, I think, loved in this community with his family foundation and wellness center. And I just think this makes people think even more highly of him.
It was phenomenal. I think it was great. And to send that message out, especially because he had such a feisty personality. Ice up, son. This is really big for other people who are going through the same things to see somebody like him admit that he went through it.
So trouble in another sport is closely associated with Charlotte this week. NASCAR chief executive and chairman Brian France charged, I think, up north somewhere with DUI and criminal drug possession in Long Island. That's where it was, Long Island, New York. He was in possession of oxycodone. Did he not have a prescription?
I am not sure, but he was charged with having it. So I'm just guessing that he wasn't supposed to have it.
So he is taking an
never a good,
good
look.
Guess.
Yeah, never a good look.
Guess. He's taking an indefinite leave of absence from NASCAR. Is that exclusively his decision? Is this a kind of a family company? Don't know? Okay.
I don't think we know what's behind the scenes.
What has been the reaction of drivers, other owners, fans since this was revealed?
Truthfully, there hasn't been all that much of an outcry after NASCAR came out about 2 hours after it came out that he had that arrest. NASCAR came out and said he's taking that indefinite leave, and the outcry after that wasn't all that strong.
So just as football season begins, the Hornets are looking ahead to the opening of their training camp in Chapel Hill to start their 30th. Can you believe this? Their 30th season. Mm. Does that count the time away from Charlotte? I guess it does. And so what do you get, a team that's been around for 30 years? What do you get for their birthday? A new court to play on, but it's actually a fallback court because it's a replica of their old court from the original Coliseum, the old Coliseum out on Tivola Road in 1995. So the classic, for the first five games, I think, the classic Hornets logo will be at center court, et cetera, et cetera. Who wants to talk about that, though, when we can talk about cuddly kittens? Very quickly, we have 15 seconds.
The airport brought some kittens out for people to see and potentially adopt. A couple of them got adopted, and a lot of people said, aw.
Okay. WBTV's Steve Crump has been a fixture in local television news for decades. He's both a reporter for Channel 3 and a documentary producer. He's been on this program many times to talk about his award-winning work. WBTV announced this week that Steve's taking a leave of absence because of an unspecified health problem, one he has described as very serious but treatable, so we want to wish him well. Alex Algan, Doss Helms, Mary C. Curtis, Sean Flynn, thank you all for the hour. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.